Apart from the first film, which is a film called Associations, which was made in 1975. That's actually the earliest film that I still show on a regular basis. What I'm going to do is show that film to begin with and then talk a little bit between a couple of the films you're going to see tonight. So we're going to start with Associations from 1975, which is 16mm, 7 minutes long. I'm always really impressed in Germany that people speak such good English, and to understand this film you need to really understand English. It's an untranslatable film into another language for reasons that will become clear. Okay, well, there's a real shift now in the next film. Things are going to get serious. Actually, not so serious. It depends how you look at it. I used to be very well known for making, well, not that well known, a bit known, for making films around the place where I live, the place that I was familiar with. And for those of you who were here last night, you will have seen, I can't remember, but I think almost all the films last night were shot in and around the place where I live. That's changed quite a lot over the last, I guess, 20 years or so, really, because I started travelling. And a lot of my films come out of the places, my experiences in the places that I visit, and usually actually through really to do with the place where I'm staying. So the next film we're going to see, Worst Case Scenario, was shot in Vienna in, when did I shoot it? I shot it in 2000 and finished it in 2001, I think. Or did I shoot it in? Anyway, I can't remember, sorry. I think 2003, sorry, I shot it in 2001 and finished it in 2003. And this film came out of going to, I was showing my work in the Stadtkino in Vienna, and I was showing a couple of programs over in two nights, and so I was in Vienna for the first time, and I didn't have anything much to do in the daytime. I just had to do a screening in the evening on two different nights, but I had a pretty bad cold, so I ended up staying in the hotel all the time, really, and just sitting there and looking out of the window. And I got very interested looking out the window of this particular hotel that I was staying in. And initially, because I was in quite a high room and I was looking down on the street, and I got interested in looking at all the road markings on the street and the tram lines and the tram cables and things, because, you know, we don't have trams in London, so it was very exotic to me to see trams going by. But just on an aesthetic, on an abstract level, I got interested in these road markings. But I also started to get very interested in Austrian traffic regulations, which I think are the same as in Germany. To do this with this thing that if the lights, cars can come around the corner, yeah, even if you've got a green light as a pedestrian to cross the road, the car can come around the corner as long as it doesn't knock you over, it's okay. Is that right? Something like that. Anyway, I know if I'm crossing a pedestrian crossing, then sometimes a car comes around and it has to wait for me, and that's in Britain that's not allowed, but it seems to work very well here. But anyway, to me, I could see there were two roads converging, and I had this sort of position from my hotel room. I felt a bit like God looking down on the earth, so I could see what was going to come around the corner when somebody was crossing the road. And for some reason, there were quite a lot of people with wheelchairs or crutches who would take a long time to get across the road and things. And I could see there was a lorry just about to come around the corner. And I kept thinking, oh, this place is like an accident waiting to happen. And, of course, nothing did happen. I started watching the people as well. There were lots of people standing in the street. And one of the reasons there were a lot of people in the street was that There was a tram stop directly opposite the hotel, and the tram stop was also outside of a bakery that was on a corner. And so there were a lot of people standing around in the street waiting to get a tram or eating a sandwich and things like that. And coming back to associations, the kind of things that are going on there with wordplay, I became very amused by the fact that, you know, I've been worrying about the fact that there might be accidents. And on the bake windows, at the signs above the windows of the bakery, there were two signs. One said Wurst and the other one said Kaiser. And I read this as worst case. So I thought, this is a worst case scenario here. So I made this video film called Worst Case Scenario, which you're about to see. At the time, I didn't do it, but I knew I wanted to make a film. I took a few photographs, and then I went away. And then 2 years later, I came back and booked into the same hotel room. And it was rather strange because it wasn't a great hotel. It was quite a scruffy hotel, but I contacted the hotel. In fact, I got the people distributor, some people you might have heard of, called Six Pack Film in Vienna. I got them to contact the hotel for me and say I wanted to check into exactly the same room as I'd been in 2010. You know, probably the first time they had a request for somebody wanted to stay in the same room because it was so special to them. And then I spent a week in this hotel room filming from the window, but not filming actually, taking still photographs. So I took, I think, about 6,000 still photographs over the course of a week, and then put them together into the film you're going to see. So it's 18 minutes long, and it's called Worst Case Scenario. Finished. 9/11 happened, and for reasons that you'll see in the coming videos, that kind of like a lot of us had quite a big impact on me, and of course the repercussions of 9/11 later, but maybe we'll talk about those things later on. What I didn't say at the beginning is, for anybody who wasn't here last night, we're just going to do the same format as yesterday, so if anybody has any, hopefully people would like to stick around and ask questions and things later. I don't like to say too much about the films during the programme. Just one thing I will say about this film, though, is that one thing I was interested in was that, you know, that thing when you hear of like a train crash or a plane crash or something, and you or somebody you know got on the plane before or the one after. And so in this video, I'm sort of bringing I'm playing with time and bringing things together at different times, which were actually in these places. I hope it's clear, it's very important in that film that you're aware that that quite crudely images are matted onto each other, so you kind of see like movements of pavement and things like that. That's quite important, because I want the process to be evident. But all the things you saw in the film, those people were in those places, but maybe not at the same time. So I'm bringing together different elements of time together within the frame, having had the camera set up, looking at one view and filming what happened within that frame over a period of time. Okay, we're now going to show three. There's a little change to the programme, by the way. Anybody who looked at the programme and was coming expecting to see White Hole, I'm afraid I'm not going to show that tonight. Instead, I'm going to show an extra video from the Hotel Diaries series. So I'm going to show three videos from a series of seven videos that I made called Hotel Diaries. They are very raw and rough and ready videos, as you'll see. They're very deliberately to do with recording a moment. I want a kind of immediacy to them. So those of you who were here last night and saw Unusual Red Cardigan, this film has a similar, these series of videos have a similar kind of quality to them, in that they're completely unedited. Each one is a single shot, and I'm talking and filming at the same time. But just to give you a little bit of background to them, the Hotel Diaries came about when in October 2001, a month after 9/11, I was at the Cork Film Festival in Ireland, and I came home to my hotel room late at night and was very curious to watch the TV news, because America and Britain had just started bombing Afghanistan. It was the second night of the bombing of Afghanistan, and I was rather disturbed about what might happen. And I came home, and sorry, I'm slowing down here because I'm trying to think. I mentioned some of this in the video. I may be repeating myself, but I'll tell you anyway. I came back to the hotel room, turned on the TV, expecting to see the news, and the image on the TV screen was frozen on the BBC News channel. And there was just an image of somebody in the middle of an interview, head and shoulders shot of a guy. And the caption on the screen read, "Second night of bombing in Afghanistan. Targets in Kabul and Jalalabad have been hit." And I started having lots of different thoughts going through my head. And I happened to have my video camera with me, and I pulled the camera out and filmed the screen of the TV and started talking about these very contradictory feelings I was having from the image I was seeing on the screen. And that ended up being the start of a series of videos that I made over 6 years, from 2001 to 2007, which kind of document the Bush and Blair era, which sadly is gone, but we don't have much good to replace it. All of these videos relate in one way to the conflicts in the Middle East and Afghanistan, but I probably said too much already. I'll show these three videos. They're the third, fourth, and fifth part of a seven video series. First is called Throwing Stones. The second is called B&B, and the third is called Pyramid Skunk, and they add up to about 20, just under half an hour of videos. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the first film that I made which is very much to do with a kind of an equal dialogue between sound and image, or word and image, and also the first film that I made where I started to explore my rather unhealthy obsession with puns that... and the worse the puns are, the more I like them, actually, so I have to say. It's quite an early film. When I first started making films, my very earliest films were all animations of still photographs, which I came back to in Worst Case Scenario, of course, many years later. But I became interested in perceptual psychology and mainly things to do with how we can read visual rhythms in time and things like that, and through that I started talking to the wife of my tutor at the time at college, who was a perceptual psychologist, and she worked a lot with language, and I was I was interested in terms of whether it would be possible within a film to read two meanings simultaneously, and so in associations, I decided I was going to explore that. All of the images, although I wouldn't expect you to get all of them, all relate to words or fragments of words and offering an alternative meaning. One thing that sort of came to interest me in making that film is because I realised when I talked to people after showing it that everybody saw different things in it, because it's impossible to actually read all of this information that's coming out so quickly. So I got interested in this sense that we can all be looking at the same thing but see it in different ways. And I think maybe that was sort of partly partly responsible for the way in which I explore ambiguity in different ways in the film and in films, in my films generally.
It's also like that you have been established a kind of alphabet, so you nearly can read the film by these images and understand the language sentences.
Yeah. I mean, for me, an interesting film, whatever that film might be, whether it's a mainstream film, an experimental film, or whatever, for me, I get interested in a film if, in some way or another, it's inventing its own language, that there is a kind of element of a new language. And I think, for me, the most exciting films that I see are films where you have to learn the language of the film as it goes along. So, and that's something which I find very fascinating. And of course, one thing that's great to play with is that you teach people a language, and just when they're starting to understand the language, you change the rules a little bit, which actually, I think, for me, makes work much more engaging.
Are there any questions for this film? If not, I will go further. Yes, please.
Just one question. Did you talk to any of those people at the worst case?
No, I didn't. No,
they
no.
They saw you at the end, right?
Yes, some of them saw me, but very few saw me. I mean, it there's a kind of intended discomfort about the film because, of course, it's very voyeuristic. I'm really looking at people from a distance. I wanted to kind of reinforce that voyeurism through the sound of the interior space of the room that you start to hear later on. Yeah, I think, you know, being in the city of Freud, I was sort of looking and analysing. I was imagining myself as a psychoanalyst, looking down and looking at people's behaviour. And, of course, it's pretty clear that there's some very kind of clichéd interpretations of Freud in the film to do with eating and sex and cleaning, and which I've come across in one way or another. I was sort of playing with that. Yeah, did you ask that question because of that kind of discomfort?
Well, I was going to ask you if you asked permission.
No, not at all. Not at all, yeah. I sort of slightly investigated the... somebody told me that under Austrian law, I think it's the same, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's probably the same in Germany, is that there are quite strict privacy rules, but if you're making something which can be classified as an artwork, you can do whatever you like. That's what I was told anyway. So, I'm interested with that film and also in the film the Girl Chewing Gum that I showed last night, both of which I'm just filming people in the street. My camera's not disguised. They can see me if they look at it, but very often people are not aware. And I'm interested in a way in creating that feeling of discomfort to make us really aware that people are being observed and manipulated, and that's one of the reasons in worst case scenario, one of the reasons that I use very mechanical movements is that I wanted to be very clear that this is not these people, it's what I'm doing with these people. So it's not a reflection on them, it's not any way kind of comment on them or their behaviour, it's what I'm doing with them. And,
scenario is also a term of making films. So have you written a scenario after having shot all these photographs or...?
Well, I didn't write a scenario, but one of the reasons it took me a long time to make the film was that I kind of needed to become really, really familiar with these 6,000 still images and decide which particular frames I was going to use. And they were all shot on a 36 exposure, 35mm still camera. So I had all of these rolls of film that I had to join together and then make a video copy from. But over the course of the shooting, themes started to emerge. I mean, I didn't know, of course, what was going to happen. I anticipated that I'd be filming people eating. I knew that there was a lot of eating going on. And waiting. I was interested in the idea of waiting. And I normally kind of warn people with that film that, you know, there's a lot of waiting. You know, it's not going to be all that exciting, at least to begin with. very early on, I realised that there were going to be dogs. There were a lot of dogs in the street, and I realised I've got quite a few shots of dogs. So after a little point, I thought, OK, I'm going to whenever a dog comes along, I'm going to film it. You know, I want to have a collection, a dog archive that I can pull different dogs out of. And I got excited when I saw somebody closing a door of a car. I thought, oh, this could be I could create a dialogue here between dogs barking and door slamming. So things built up over time. But for me, the exciting thing was to discover at the end of the day when the bakery closed down that they would wash all the floors and the water would run out into the street. And so there was this kind of cleansing of the environment going on, which took on a quite a significance. I mean, I said earlier about it being, I edited it after 9/11, and as you saw from the hotel diaries, that time was kind of pretty. I was pretty affected by it, having been in America at the time and things. And then also after we started bombing Afghanistan and things, and preparing to attack Iraq. When I was editing the worst case scenario, certainly those world events were kind of affecting actually how I was editing it. I don't know if people get this sense from it. It's probably pretty understated. But I was interested in the way I wanted to kind of create a sort of sense of suspicion between people, because there was so much kind of it was just at the time when sort of Islamophobia was really starting to rise, and people would be suspicious of of an Asian person on a bus and things like this. So I was interested in Vienna with sort of which is quite multicultural, seeing how people look at each other. So I'm sort of trying to suggest that people are kind of looking at each other and then I'm looking at them. So it's all kind of suspicious and to do with the other, really. Sort of, I wonder what that person's like, what are they doing? But I don't know how much that comes across, but that was, for me, that played quite a big part in how I decided to edit.
Yes, this film is full of associations, I think, and it's like a dramatic climax, and the Freudian impetus you're giving in the beginning of the film, which is filmed elsewhere, of course.
Yeah, a different street, yeah. I did have there was a whole part of the film which I never included, which I'm glad I never put in, but when I was in Vienna, the first time, I thought I'll go to the Freud Museum, and I'd already thought of this thing of the worst case idea. And I don't know if anybody's been to the Freud Museum in Vienna, or if it's the same now. But certainly when I went there in whenever it was, 2001, the first thing that you saw when you went into the museum was a whole collection of Freud's cases, suitcases, that were in a display case. So the cases within cases. Of course, because Freud left Austria in a hurry prior to the Second World War, there were very few artifacts left of Freud's, but they're all very fetishized in the museum. The time I went there, I remember there was like a cigar butt, Freud's cigar butt in the display case and things. But I was very interested in seeing these cases, and I was thinking of, because I was thinking of worst case scenario, and I was thinking, Freud's case histories, his case studies, So I spent some time and effort to persuade the Freud Museum to let me film their cases and animate these cases. One of the things I liked about them was they all had the monogram SF on them, which stands, as we know, for science fiction as well. And I kind of I wanted to make this sort of play with this ideas around fictionalizing reality. And to begin with, I was thinking in a much more literal way. I was thinking I would make some of these people in the street, I would make them the characters in Freud's case studies and things. And I thought, no, it's just all too much. So I got rid of it all, and all I kept was the image of the Freud Museum at the beginning, for reasons of what I do with the editing. And I quite like to sort of set up an expectation of something to do with Freud, which you forget and possibly come back to later.
There may be a lot of interpretation for your film, but I would just like to introduce one. You're alone in the hotel room, and I was a little bit amazed that you are introducing yourself in the film, because it's not necessary in this case. Mm-hmm. And I wondered why. So it's like the reflection of the scenario we are seeing. It's very filled up with love scenes, and so it's perhaps
Okay. Well, I should say actually I wasn't alone. I did have somebody, a friend came with me, and we filmed together, and because I thought this is going to be too creepy. If I'm in a hotel room for a week on my own filming out of the window, somebody may confront me, and I don't think I can cope with it. So I took my friend Patrick, who's a cinematographer, and we took it in turns to film, which is why you can actually see me at the window, because we had two cameras. There are two reasons. One of them is very much to do with I wanted to create a kind of triangle of spaces. I don't know whether people notice it, but basically the colour shots are all point of view shots from street level. So the only shots you see in colour represent the points of view of people down in the street. So there's nothing, everything is black and white from above. So but also there is the exterior sound and the interior sound. So for me, the kind of sounds of like chairs creaking and cigarette lighters and things, and this kind of obviously interior space is important to kind of suggest the triangle of looking, you know, of voyeurism. But to be honest, one of the reasons that the phone is there is I really like... I like to work with silence in film, as you've seen in a lot of the films that very often sometimes sound just cuts to silence, and as we know, silence can be very loud after a lot of noise. Silence can be a very loud thing, but I like the idea of introducing this very quiet mobile phone ringing after, you know, 2 minutes of complete silence, so that people think, oh, is there a phone in the cinema? And that was the one of the strong reasons for doing it, because very often I show that video and people look around and they realise it's something, it's the soundtrack. I sort of felt I needed to put my own identity in it as well, because I'm kind of watching all these people, you know, it's like I should actually, you know, I mean, I'm not giving much away about myself, but I am sort of reminding of the fact that there is a filmmaker who's actually recording these events.
Are there any questions for a worst case scenario at the moment? No. So it's like it was a kind of transition to the first person cinema, the Hotel Diaries. So we have seen the third to the sixth part.
That's right.
Yes, and how many parts are they? Are there right now?
Seven altogether, and I stopped in 2007. I made the last one.
Okay.
But I might make another series, but it turned out by accident really that I was documenting Blair and Bush, and when I stopped in 2007. Blair had just gone. We had a new prime minister, and I can't remember now whether Obama had. I think had Obama been elected in 2007, or was he about
November?
So in fact, the last one of these was made in October 2007, and I didn't really want to make another one after that, because I wanted to be optimistic about the future, having finally got rid of Bush, and we had a new prime minister, and we also had a new prime minister in Britain. So I decided I would stop the series at that time, although I may make series two at some point. I don't know. We'll see.
So the beginning was the political situation. And why actually you find this kind of format or situation, so coming home late or being elsewhere, not at home but in a foreign country, and and then reflecting your personal day and then switching to politics, perhaps you can...
Well, I think more and more, again, since 2001, I felt that world politics actually, what's happening in the wider world impacts more and more on your own life. You know, we have terrible laws that have been brought in because of those things that have happened to do with... So in Britain, at least, there are lots of problems with the possible curtailment of human rights and free speech because of the consequences of that time. But what happened with... It really did start by accident because I started to say earlier I was in this hotel room and I came home and the TV screen was frozen and I started to get these thoughts going through my head, these very contradictory thoughts. One was that I felt kind of disturbed when I turned on the TV that I couldn't access news. Partly, I think, because less than a month before, I said I'd been in America and I sort of started to have these paranoid fantasies of like, oh, has there been a bomb gone off in London and blown up the BBC transmitter or something? Which, of course, is like a very unlikely scenario. And also, I got very annoyed with myself that I was kind of being paranoid about the fact my TV wasn't working, whereas I knew that at that moment my country was dropping bombs in Afghanistan and killing thousands of innocent people. So I had these kind of contradictory things went through my head, and I just got the camera out and started talking about what was going on. But the later videos that you saw today are more contrived, but they're all basically the same situation of using the hotel room as a kind of found film set, what happens there, what might happen while I'm in the place, and making metaphorical connections. But what it made me think of as well is really to do with, I think we're more aware of how what we know is mediated by media. I think somehow if you're in another country, that comes across more strongly, because I was thinking, I can't see this person's face on the TV. But I was also thinking, well, if I do hear what he's saying, will I trust it anyway? And of course, travelling a lot, I have the privilege of, not the right word, but quite often if I'm in a hotel in another country in Europe, I can only see CNN news or Fox News, so I get really right-wing representations of things. Of course, the BBC is pretty... It's moved a lot more to the right in terms of how it presents things. So, for me, that sort of sense of how much are we finding out about a situation is stronger when you're in another place. So, in a sense, it's a kind of expansion of what I was talking about with worst case scenario. It's like a triangle of places. There's the place where something is actually happening. There's the place that you're in, and the place that what's happening is being reported from, which is generally another place from the place where things are actually occurring.
So you were filming while speaking, and do you think before you're going to film to record it, are you thinking about what you're reflecting on, or does it come in your mind?
It's the one I just was talking about, Frozen Moor, that was completely spontaneous, but all of the others are completely choreographed. They're totally planned. When I say they're totally planned, they're not scripted word for word, but I know what I'm going to talk about, I know the order I'm going to talk about things in, and I know what the camera's going to be looking at. They are very, very, very planned. But I like the discipline of having to make them in a short period of time, because I'm probably only in that hotel for 3 days and then I'm going back somewhere. But quite often, I think of a piece one day and then go around in my head and then I make it the next day. I mean, actually, in two of the videos, you actually see my notebooks lying around, and they're the script basically. And I sort of deliberately leave them. Like, if you look very closely, you'll notice it says things which relate to what I'm talking about. But there is this interesting thing, I think, when you're looking through a camera, and I always just look, I'm not very professional, when I look through a camera, I close this eye, I just look through one eye, through a viewfinder, and I find if I'm doing making these pieces or similar pieces, I find sometimes during the act of filming, I'll notice something through the camera which I'll comment on. So they're, although things are planned, there are also improvisational elements in them as well. But I want them to have this kind of immediacy, and it's important that they're not scripted, because I don't want them to be didactic. I mean, I don't, you know, what I have to say is not nothing particularly clever. I'm saying I'm expressing how I feel about a situation. To do with this kind of the crossover between the personal and the wider world, it's I think it's because things do impinge on your everyday consciousness. I mean, I'm one of these people, I'm stupid enough in the morning to wake up and I turn on the radio and I listen to the news on the radio, and it very often spoils my day. I don't know why I do it, but so we see things through what we're thinking about, of course.
There's a question. Yes, please. Yes, of course, yes. Go
I wanted to know how you see your renommé in comparison to Vivian Meyer's relative notoriety. I understand you were recently in Chicago, and I thought, like, you said that your father is a pack rat, and he says anything that could be useful. And
I'm sorry, I can't hear. My hearing's not very good.
Are you familiar with the work of Vivian Meyer and the film that came out about her recently?
Of who, Vivian?
Vivian Meyer.
Vivian Meyer?
I understood you were in Chicago recently, and they made a film about her, and she's got tons and tons of photos that were unpublished. Doesn't matter. Okay, uh-huh. So what about your own films? You said you had 6,000 stills in Vienna, and I was wondering, like, compared to the productions that you've already done, what is the amount of film that you've just never, you know, delved into and used as material?
No, there were 6,000 still photographs that I took, which I made worst-case scenario from. So, the film is made up from individual photographs from all of these 6,000 images that I took over the course of 1 week. So,
and so compared to your lifetime of images that you may have taken, and you said it took a long time to do the editing of that film, what percent of images you may have produced that you just haven't used as your palette in your creative process?
Well, in terms of a shooting ratio, so if I might shoot, 4 hours of material to make a half hour film,
right?
I guess it's sort of I probably use a that's a very hard question to answer. I shoot a lot more than I end up in a final film. But I don't very often start a film that I don't finish. I don't have that many ideas. So if I have an idea, I make the film.
Great. So you don't have stuff in the pipeline that you would go back to?
There are one or two things that have been in the pipeline for so long. I don't think I ever will. But it's possible. It's possible.
Okay, and the other question about that Vienna film, I wondered if you had to get like a special film permission to take the shots, and the other one with the all the hotel rooms, if you had to get one, because I had the experience of Hotel Bogota in Berlin that you had to get a special permission if you're going to take any shots in their hotel.
Well, they didn't know. They didn't know. The hotel in Vienna knew, and the manager of the hotel was very amused by the fact that I spent the whole week in the hotel filming out of the window, and I did tell him that that's what I was going to do, and it was rather annoying actually, because whenever he went out in the street, he'd wave at me very often when there was something really interesting happening.
Thank you.
I'll other questions so far? Because we don't have...
Just what you were mentioning there about when you're filming, you close one eye.
Uh-huh.
So does the world look differently when you're looking through your camera? Does it change sometimes more than you expect, or is it pretty much what you expect?
It can be different, yeah, and that's why I was saying that sometimes things come into your mind actually when you're looking through the world framed, yeah. So it's and then when you're actually shutting down the amount of information that you're looking at, and especially if the camera's quite close, maybe you notice detail that you wouldn't otherwise notice. But for me, the whole thing of looking through the camera is very important in the Hotel Diaries videos, because they required quite a lot of concentration to be able to film and talk at the same time and coordinate those two things, which is the reason they're all shot in the middle of the night. I mean, first one's at 4 in the morning, the second one, you hear the clock chime, I don't know when the others are, but they're generally shot right in the middle of the night, because any distraction, any kind of sound of something else or something would just throw me. And, but they are made in several... most of them made in several takes, so I think all of the videos you saw tonight, I probably did 3 or 4 takes until I got one that felt right. So they're nothing like as spontaneous as they intended to appear.
Other questions from the audience? Just last one. One last question. So the last film is very different from the other films, from all the other films we have seen, actually. Perhaps not so, because you're also introducing written word and palimpsest. It's like a palimpsest, so working on memories and... Yes, but the very personal relationship to you as a person, have you worked a lot with this kind of personal approach?
Not much at all. I made one very long video called Home Sweet, where the camera travelled around in the same vein as the Hotel Diaries. It was the first video piece I made in the mid-90s. And in Home Sweet, the camera travelled around the house that I lived in extreme close-up, and I would tell stories about things that had happened in the house, and that was very personal. And I won't go into details, but it was very personal. With Dad's Stick, it was very important to me to use captions rather than a spoken voice, because I'm talking about things which are kind of very loaded in places. I really wanted the neutrality of a caption, so I really like the use of the possibilities for using of captions, because there's no intonation. We don't know how something's being said. Whether it's and in Death Stick, it's sort of intended that there are parts of it where you're not sure whether it's supposed to be funny or whether it's deadly serious or both. It can be both things. So particularly parts like where I say, my dad used to beat me with a piece of washing line that he kept behind the television. It didn't happen often. He hated having to do it. I really like putting that in captions, because it could be kind of sarcastic or not. It's actually what he said to me as an adult. I remember when I was sort of... Not so many years before he died. He used to paint this rosy picture of what family life had been like with him, my mother and children. And one day I sort of said to him, look, it wasn't like that, you know. It was pretty shitty sometimes. And you used to beat me with this piece of washing line, you know. And he said, yeah, no. I hated having to do it. but I was a horrible child.
But you were singing the song. It was you, of course.
Yeah. I'm taking on my father's. It's about kind of. To me, the most important thing of the film really is the last shot where you see the teacup, and I talk about my grandparents. I was interested in this whole generational thing, that something that's precious to one person becomes rubbish later down the line, and everything ends up in the dump in the end, you know. But so it's nice that the
you know, my grandparents' tea cup was their best. It was their best tea service, you know. And then my dad used, because the cup handle must have got broken, so my dad just used to mix his paint in it. And then, of course, the stick that he used to stir his paint was of no value to him at all. And then that's my most, probably the most precious object I have. If my house was burning down, I'd go and rescue Dad's stick. partly because he showed it to me very shortly before he died. And he, you know, he, I hope it's clear, it was him that cut through it, not me. And I went round to see him one day. It was probably only a month or so before he died. And at that point, he was not very well. And he was sort of, I think he was sort of getting ready to go, you know, and he was looking back on his life. He used to spend a lot of time looking at family photographs and things like that, and in a way this was kind of the same thing, because cutting through this stick, as I say in the film, he could look back on all the places that he lived and and it went back a long time. I mean, what was amazing to me, what became really poignant, was when I looked at these colours, I recognised some of them from my childhood, and about halfway through the stick, there is a bright orange colour from the 1960s, from when I was about 10. And that's only halfway. So I realised that this stick is a lot more than 50 years of history, is it? And it's only 2.5 centimetres wide. And, so it was very poignant thing.